I know him, though I didn't know he was a wizard. Did he tell you why they wanted you enough to take you from Redurn? Asked Foran. Then a strange expression came over his face. Is that the Redurn that belongs to the Sept of Lehi?
Yes,
Tyr agreed.
Eivor,
said Foran almost to himself. Eivor, Tyr recalled, was the given name of the new Sept. The new Sept who was supposed to be so influential with the Emperor.
Is Eivor a member of this path?
Tyr shrugged.
I don't know. The only two I've met by name are Telleridge and Myrseria, and I don't think she'd be considered a member.
Foran got to his feet and began pacing.
Why you? He asked again. Why did they go all the way to Redurn to find you? You aren't a traveler. Not if you're a farmer in Redurn who used to be a soldier.
Because I have a magical talent usually associated with the travelers, replied Tyr.
Preempting the next question, he began telling Foran what he knew about the orders. Foran held up a hand.
Enough, he said. I believe you. Let's get you out of here, then you can explain anything you feel necessary.
Tyr followed him to the threshold, but when he leaned forward to step through the door, white-hot pain convulsed his body, and a shock of magic threw him back several feet into the cell.
What was that? Said Foran, startled.
He is bound, said the memory. It sounded like a crow's mating call, or the rattle of dry bones. Tyr wobbled to his feet.
It talks?
The Emperor looked at the memory.
Sometimes. But this is the first time it's ever volunteered information. Are you all right?
Tyr nodded.
Your memory is right. There must be some sort of magic here I cannot cross.
Can you do something with it? Didn't you say that you have magic?
He is bound, said the memory again.
Stop that,
said Tyr, a command that usually worked when Jess began to get too creepy. He turned to Foran.
I don't have the kind of magic that could counter this, and they have managed to keep me from what little useful magic I do have. It looks like I'm stuck here.
Foran nodded.
Very well.
He came back into the room and shut the door.
There are wizards who are supposed to serve me, or serve the Empire at least, but I don't know if any of them are the ones who belong to the path. Find out who the path's wizards are, and then maybe I can find a wizard to undo this.
He gave Tyr an apologetic look.
I am more Emperor in name than in reality, or I could just order your release. The 20th, 19th by common reckoning, had real power.
Tyr grinned.
That's because he'd ordered the death of 15 septs by the time he was your age, and accounted for another 3 or 4 personally.
I'm rather finicky in my food choices, said Foran with mock sadness. I'll never manage to be properly terrifying.
You wouldn't have to suck the marrow from their bones the way the 20 did, said Tyr solemnly. I suspect a cooked heart or two would do just fine.
I don't eat heart, said Foran firmly. Though I suppose I could feed it to the grieving heir. That might have a similar effect.
Tyr and Foran gave each other a look of mutual approval.
I already owe you a favor, said Foran. But your experience is different than my own. I'd like your opinion on my problem.
He waved at the memory.
I am always your servant, my Emperor.
Tyr was rather pleased to find that he meant it.
For the past 3 months,
Foran began,
I've had this creature. Not that it follows me all the time, you understand. Usually it just visits me once a night.
He smiled grimly and sat down on the bed. Tyr followed his example and collapsed on the other end of the bed. He should have waited until the Emperor bid him sit,
but between whatever happened during the time he couldn't remember and the jolt the doorway had given him, his joints were all but jelly.
"Sometimes when I can't sleep," Foran said, "I go exploring the shut-off places in the palace. I have this key."
He took one out of his pocket.
"It's supposed to open every door in the palace. It didn't do yours, but it opened the turnkey's box that had your key in it."
He put it away and began his story again.
"Anyway, one night a few months ago I was wandering through the Kaor Wing. That's one of the ones my father shut down, I'm told. It's usually pretty boring. Long corridors with identical rooms on either side. That sort of thing. But this time I heard some noise at the end of one of the corridors. No one's supposed to be there, but sometimes people are. I sneaked down to a door that was ajar."
He pulled the velvet fabric of his pants and absently rubbed it between thumb and index finger.
"There were a number of people in dark robes with hoods over their heads. They were standing in a loose circle, chanting. A seventh man was kneeling, blindfolded and bound in the center. If I'd known what they were going to do, I'd have tried to stop it somehow. But by the time I saw the knife, it was too late. One of the robed men had already slit the bound man's throat."
Foran got off the bed and began to pace restlessly.
"There was blood everywhere. I hadn't realized. It was too late for the dead man, and I thought that they might not be too excited at having a witness, so I left as quickly as I could.
The memory came to me the next night." Foran looked at the creature solemnly, then sank back onto the bed and began rolling up his sleeve.
"It comes to me every night," he said,
showing tear marks on the inside of his wrist that climbed in fading scars to the hollow of his elbow.
"After it feeds, it tells me that in return, it owes me the answer to a question. Usually its answers aren't very useful. Tonight, I asked if it knew someone who could tell me something about the Sept of Jurant's lands, and it brought me here."
Tyr said,
"You think that you interrupted them killing their last traveler prisoner?"
He considered it.
"I think you are right. How many groups of dark-robed men do you have going around killing people in the palace?"
"There might be as many as 5 or 10, he said. "But not that managed to summon or create something like this."
He pointed at his dark comrade.
"This is wizardry."
Tyr nodded slowly.
"I'm not a wizard, but I've dealt with them. If this was something that might result from their meddling, I'd think they'd be careful that it would not attach itself to them. Maybe some magic. That would mean that you were the only one there it could attach itself to."
He got off the bed and walked closer to the memory. His eyes wouldn't quite focus on it, reminding him forcibly of the way Jess could fade into the shadows when he wanted to.
"How did you know that I could answer the Emperor's question tonight?"
asked Tyr. The thing shifted restlessly.
"You fed me true," it said at last. "I know you as I know Foran, 27th Emperor of that name."
"I fed you?"
Tyr asked.
"Numberless were the heroes who fell," whispered the memory in a voice quite different than it had been using. It was no longer without inflection. The change was remarkable.
"You were my listener?"
said Tyr.
"I was Kareen, to your Red Urnave," agreed the memory.
"What else are you?"
Tyr took a step nearer to it.
"I am death," it said,
and was gone.
"Did you understand what it meant?"
asked Foran. Tyr rubbed his hands together lightly.
"Only a bit of it," he said. "Apparently it feeds on more than just blood. I gave it a story, and it took more than I offered. which is how it knew that I'd been one of Gerant's commanders.
He'd invoked magic in that story, more magic than he'd ever brought forth before. And it had only been shortly after that when Telleridge had informed him that his magic was contained. He'd thought that Telleridge had meant that they'd taken his magic away. But perhaps it was more subtle than that.
"Would you tell me a lie?"
he asked Foran.
"My stallion is cowhocked," he said immediately, apparently unfazed by the abrupt change in subject. "What are you doing?"
"Well," said Tyr, "I misunderstood what Telleridge meant when he said they had contained my magic. I can tell if you lie, but not Telleridge or Mircea. Your magic works, but not on the members of the path," Foran said.
"So it seems."
"I have two more requests before I go," said Foran. "First, I ask that you not tell anyone about the memory."
He gave Tyr another bleak smile.
"It's more than a social problem for me, you know. If a whisper of the memory got out, I'd face a headsman's axe. The Empire cannot forget the lessons learned from the Shadowed. The Emperor must be free of magic."
"Without your permission, no one will hear it from my lips," promised Tyr.
"Would you see if you can find out if your sept, Eivor, the Sept of Lehi, is a member of the Secret Path?"
He sighed.
"Telleridge is a spider who avoids the light of day while he spins his webs and sends his friends and foes whirling in deadly earnest, unaware whose threads pull them this way and that. If he is involved with the Secret Path, then they are a threat to me and vice versa. I need to know who I can trust."
"If I can discover it," Tyr agreed, then gave his emperor a wry grin.
"Since I don't have any choice about staying, I might as well make myself useful."
He slept for a while after Foran left. He had no idea how long, because his cell allowed for no daylight, just the endless glow of the stones that lit his room. Longing for home brought him to his feet. Frustration sent him pacing. He hadn't been able to ask if Foran could get a message to Seraph. His tongue wouldn't shape the words. "By Cormorant and Owl, I bind you that you will not ask anyone to help you escape." Seraph would help him escape if she could. He supposed that was enough to invoke Telleridge's magic. If Seraph knew where to find him. But she did not. She probably thought him dead after all this time. He probably would die without seeing her again. There was something in the arrogance of Telleridge that told Tyr that many travelers had died here. Tyr closed his eyes and rested his face against the cool stone wall. Without the distraction of sight, he could pull her into his heart's thoughts. Owl memory, she called it, when he was able to recall conversations held months before. Gifted, his grandfather said, when he could sing a song after the first time he'd heard it. Blessed, he thought now, visualizing the pale-faced child Seraph had been the first time he'd seen her. Blessed to have his memories to keep in his heart in this place. In his mind's eye, he built her face as it had been, little by little, loving the curve of her shoulder and the odd, pale color of her hair. Proud. He thought. She had been so proud. It was in the stubborn set of her chin, raised in defiance of the men in that tavern. He could see the bruise on her wrist where the innkeeper had grabbed her and yanked her out of bed. He'd been intrigued by her then, he thought, as he had before. In the clear light of his memory, he could see how young she'd been, little more than a child. And yet, they'd been married less than a season later. Eschewing the luxuries his cell now offered, Tyr sat on the floor and set his back against the wall. He remembered the very moment that he knew he loved her. 2 days after Jess was born, Tyr came back from the barn to find Seraph
sitting on the end of the bed, back straight as a board, with Jess held protectively in her arms.
"I have something to say to you," she said, as welcoming as an angry hedgehog.
He took off his coat and hung it up.
"All right,"
he'd said. Wondering how he'd managed to offend her this time. Her eyes narrowed, she told him that their son was a guardian. She explained how difficult Jess would find it to maintain a balance between daytime and nighttime personalities.
"If you were a girl, he would stand a better chance," she said, in the cold, clear voice she only used when she was really upset. "Male guardians seldom maintain their balance after puberty. If they become maddened, they will kill anyone who crosses their path except for those in their charge. Once that happens, they must be killed because they cannot be confined."
Jess began to fuss, and she set him against her shoulder and rocked him gently, keeping Tyr at a distance by the force of her gaze.
"I had a brother who was a guardian, adopted from another tribe. Often, guardians are given to other clans to raise because the normal anxieties of birth parents seem to add strain to the guardian's burden. It is an honor to raise a guardian child, and no clan would refuse to take him."
"Give up his son?"
The shock of the suggestion ripped cleanly through dismay that had encased him as he realized the terrible thing that the gods had laid upon his small son. How could she think that he'd entertain a suggestion that they throw Jess away because he was too much trouble? How could she consider deserting her child? She wouldn't. Not she. She who fought demons for people she didn't even know would never, ever shrink at anything that would threaten her second family.
"How old was your guardian brother when he died?" asked Tyr finally.
"Rissavar was 30, she said, her hands fluttering restlessly over Jess as if she wanted to clutch him close, but was afraid she might hurt him if she did. "He was among the first who died of the plague."
"Then you know how it is done," Tyr said. "Jess will stay with us, and you will teach me how to raise a guardian who will die of ripe old age."
Her face had come alive then, and he saw what it had cost her to be honest with him. When he cradled his family against him, mother and child, she'd whispered,
"I'd have killed anyone who would have tried to take him."
"Me too,"
Tyr had said fiercely into her moon-colored hair. No one would ever separate them.
"Me too,"
said Tyr in his cell in the palace at Taella. How best to weather this captivity? The answers came to him in Jurant's dry tenor.
"Know your enemy. Know what they want, so you know where to expect their next attack. Discover their strengths and avoid them. Find their weaknesses and exploit them with your strengths. Knowledge is a better weapon than a sword."
He smiled affably when Mircea entered his room.
"If you would come with me, sir," she said, "we'll make you ready for presentation. After the ceremony, you'll be given the freedom of the Eyrie and all the pleasures it can provide you."
The women who'd tried to bathe him once before were back in the bathing pool, and this time Mircea wouldn't let him send them out. They scrubbed, combed, shaved, trimmed, and ignored his blushes and protests. When one of the women started after his hair, Mircea caught her hand.
"No, leave it long. We'll braid it, and it will look properly exotic."
They persuaded him into court clothing, the like of which he'd have never willingly put on. He might actually have refused to wear them, even with his resolution to be a meek and mild guest while he gathered knowledge of his enemy, if it weren't for the fear in their eyes. He could see that, if they didn't turn him out pretty as a lady's mare, it wouldn't be him that suffered. So he protested and made rude comments, but he wore the silly things. There was a polished metal mirror embedded in the wall, and the women pushed and shoved him until he stood in front of it. Baggy red velvet trousers, tight at waist and ankles, were half concealed by a tunic that hung straight from shoulder to knees. From the weight of it, the tunic was real cloth of gold. Under the tunic, his shirt was blood red silk, embroidered with metallic gold thread. They'd shaved his face smooth, then oiled his hair with something that left flakes of metal in it that caught the light as he moved. Then they'd braided it with gold and red cords that gradually replaced his own hair, so the braid hung down to his hips, where it ended in gold and red tassels. On his feet were gold slippers encrusted with bits of red glass. At least he hoped it was glass. After looking at the full effect, he hung his head and closed his eyes.
"Lassies, if my wife ever saw me like this, she'd never let me live it down."
Mircea tapped him playfully with one manicured finger. "You look handsome, admit it. We did a good job, ladies, although he wasn't so bad to start out." Tyr looked at himself in the mirror again. If he looked carefully, he could see how the outfit might have been inspired by travelers' garments. They wore the loose pants and the knee-length tunic, but one of the things that Seraph liked about Redurni clothes was the bright colors. Her own people wore mostly undyed fabrics or earth tones. Tyr sighed.
"I'm glad there's no one here who knows me. I'd never live this down."
They covered his magnificent gaudiness with a brown robe and pulled its hood down to hide his face. "There now," said Mircea. "You are ready." She hesitated, and the practiced manner of a court whore faded a little. "You've made our job easier," she said. "Let me help you a little. The wizards will be waiting when we take you out the door. Go with them quietly, they won't hurt you. They'll escort you through the aerie, the largest room that belongs to the path. It's an auditorium tonight, but usually it is just a room for people to gather in. The wizards will take you to the stage at the end and introduce you to the passerines and whatever raptors decided to come." He took her hand in his and bent to kiss it.
"Thank you for your kindness, Mircea. Ladies?"
There were four men in black robes waiting for him, just as Mircea had promised. Like him, their hoods were pulled over their faces. Tyr hesitated in the doorway, unprepared for the fearful reluctance he felt at the sight of them and the sudden conviction that he'd seen the knobby hands of the man nearest him, holding a small knife, wet with blood. He repressed his fear and the anger it called. With a small smile, he set himself in the center of the procession.
"Shall we go, gentlemen?"
he said pleasantly. The aerie was made up of broad shelves of level flooring with short drops between sections. The level shelves narrowed as they neared the stage at the far side of the room. The uppermost section, where Tyr and his escort entered, was mostly occupied by a bar laden with food. Behind the bar was an open doorway where servants appeared with trays of food or armloads of ale mugs. There were a few tables against the wall with white-robed men who watched Tyr mostly indifferently. But most of the people in the room were young men in blue robes who quieted as the procession passed them by. By the time they reached the stage, the room was eerily silent. The wizards walked Tyr onto the stage and stopped in the middle, turning as one to face the audience. As soon as they stood there, the lights in the aerie dimmed except for the stones that lined the edge of the stage. Squinting against the odd light, Tyr saw that everyone in the room was slowly moving down to the chairs set in front of the stage. When they had all gathered, a hollow boom made the aerie shudder, and in a cloud of smoke and magic, a fifth black-robed man appeared. Telleridge. He stood bareheaded before the crowd so that every man there could see him.
"My friends," he said, For some of you, this will be the first introduction to the secrets of our path. Traveler magic from the hands of the five gods.
He lifted his right hand up and displayed an implement that looked like a morning star without the spiked ball. Instead, dangling on the end of the chain was a large silver owl.
Owl, who is barred, he said.
The man on Tyr's left front held up a similar item with a raven rather than an owl.
Raven, who is mage, he said.
Five gods, thought Tyr. If they were using the orders, they were missing one. The other wizards called out lark, cormorant, and falcon, but there was no eagle. He would have fretted about it more, but he remembered where he'd heard of the five gods before. The new priest in Redurne.
Seraph, he thought in panic. My children, who would they take next?
A flood of magic interrupted Tyr's worrying.
For centuries,
Telleridge said, his voice carried to the far corners of the room by magic.
The travelers hid their power from us, just as the Emperor and his septs hide their lands and titles away from us, thinking that they have rendered us powerless, helpless. But we are the followers of the secret path and hidden gods. We worship the birds. Raven for magic. Lark for life and death. Cormorant to rule the seas. Falcon to find our prey. And owl to lead men into our darkness. Tonight, my friends, we will all partake of darkness.
He took a step to the side so the audience had an unobstructed view of Tyr. At the same time, one of the wizards who stood behind Tyr pulled off his robe. He said something as well, too soft for Tyr to catch, but whatever it was, it froze Tyr motionless.
Raven is flown, said the man who held the raven symbol. Gone from our keeping.
At his words, Telleridge flung his free hand up, and the whole room erupted into howls, like a pack of hunting dogs. Tyr would have been impressed if the effect hadn't had a practiced polish. This was a response trained into the Passerines, a war cry without passion. The wizards Tyr could see put the chains over their shoulder, balancing their symbols with the handle hanging down their back, leaving the birds in front where they could be seen. With their hands free, they began to clap in a slow, restless rhythm. 14 beats into it, there was an echo from the audience. By the 20th beat, the noise was loud enough to account for everyone in the room except for Tyr. On the 35th beat, everyone stopped, leaving only Tyr's heart beating still. The wizard with the raven said again,
"Raven is flown!"
An older man in white stood up and said,
"So farewell the raven. What guest have you brought?"
Telleridge said,
"We bring the owl, cunning and beautiful, that he will give us the gift of music."
The Passerines replied then, as if one man spoke with 100 mouths.
"By blood shall we bind him, by fire shall we seal our bargain. By blood shall we free him after a year and a day." "As you will," said Telleridge.
He touched the owl, and a small blade shot out at the end of the owl's feet. With measured steps, he walked to Tyr's side. He took Tyr's helpless wrist and made a shallow cut. Then he held the knife beneath the wound until the silver blade was completely covered in blood. He went to the wizard with the raven and touched a finger to the blade, and then touched the wizard's raven.
"By blood," said the raven wizard.
Telleridge repeated the procedure with the others. When he was finished, he resumed his former position to the right of the raven wizard. The ceremony was nonsense as far as magic went, Tyr knew. The only magic that had been done was the spell that kept him still. But Tyr could read audiences. Excitement filled the room like some heady wine.
"Raptors, Passerines, masters all, I give you the owl."
Telleridge called, and the audience roared to their feet. When the cheering and hooting died down, Telleridge held up his hand, snapped his fingers, and a lute appeared in his hand.
"Play for us, Bard," said Telleridge, "and we will grant you guesting rights."
As easily as that, Tyr could move. Quickly, he considered his options and chose the one that appealed to him the most. He took the lute the Owl Master held out to him, a beautiful instrument to look at, but when he played a few notes, he shook his head.
"Miseria, lass,"
he said, letting his voice find her wherever she waited in the darkness that disguised the further rows of the audience.
"Hie you back to my rooms and bring my lute, please. This one your master's provided is garbage for all it's pretty."
The problem with solemn ceremonies and young men, Tyr knew, was that the urge to break the solemnity was almost irresistible. They greeted his informal request with a roar more spontaneous than the one they'd given Telleridge, if not as loud. As easily as that, he took the crowd from the wizard and lessened the effect of the earlier ceremony in the minds of everyone present. He wouldn't have tried it if his cell were far away, but it should only take a moment to retrieve the lute, not long enough to make his audience restless.
"Bard!" called a young man. "I thought an owl could play any instrument."
Tyr nodded his head.
"I've heard that too, but no one ever said they would play any instrument just because they could."
It wasn't Mirceria, but one of the passerines who ran up with the lute from Tyr's cell. Tyr took up the battered lute and sat on the edge of the stage, one long leg hanging over the edge. He'd only had her a night, but the lute felt like an old friend as he cradled her and coaxed her back into tune again.
"Now," he said, "what kind of song should it be?"
He played a rippling series of scales so quickly it was hard to pick out the individual notes.
"No," he shook his head. "No one except another musician would like that."
He tightened a peg again to bring a string back into pitch. He'd have to watch that one, he thought. Probably a new string.
"War song sounds stupid on a lute,"
he said, picking enough of a familiar melody out that a few heads began to nod.
"At least they sound stupid without a drum." "Play Shadows Fall,"
said someone over the suggestions in the crowd. Tyr shook his head. It'd be a while before he used that story again.
"No, everyone knows that. What about a love ballad?"
He struck a few chords of a particularly flowery piece and laughed at the groans from the audience.
"Fine," he said. "Try this one for size."
And he began the song he'd intended to sing from the very first. It was a wickedly funny story of a lowborn killer who, on impulse, stole the clothes of a rich young man he'd been paid to kill and set himself up as a nobleman. Tyr smiled to himself as he saw that the young men in the audience enjoyed rude double meanings and clever wording as much as the soldiers he'd fought with. The lute, for all that it was battered, was easily the finest he'd ever played. Responsive and clear-toned, it sang out, complimenting his voice and lending just the right accent to the words. He started into the third verse, the crowd silent, muffling their laughter so that they wouldn't miss a word. Even with such a fine instrument, it was difficult to get the volume he needed before this many people. With his encouragement, they joined in the final chorus, making the stage vibrate with the sheer volume. He ended it with a flourish. He could sense the wizards moving forward, but he decided to end the performance without them.
"Now," he said with a deliberately engaging grin, "come join me for the feast and drink or two, and I'll do my best to be entertaining."
Lute in hand, he jumped off the high stage, away from the wizards, and led the horde to an invasion of the bar in the back of the room. Chapter 10 It was almost dark when Jess got back to the farm. Gurra greeted him from the porch, and Jess ruffled his fingers through the wiry hair. The guardian had been demanding today. Jess was tired, and his head hurt. He tried not noticing that there was something wrong because he didn't know if he could keep the Guardian under control this time, if there was. Rinny hadn't come out when Gura barked. The Guardian also knew he was tired, and he was willing to wait until they knew for certain. So it was Jess who walked to the back of the cabin and saw that Rinny had done a few hours' worth of work before putting her tools away where they belonged. Had Rinny grown impatient and set out after Mother and Lair? He didn't think so, especially since she'd left Gura here. He followed Mother and Lair's tracks to the woods, but he couldn't see anything that indicated Rinny had come here today. The ground around the cabin was too packed down for him to follow a trail there. Reluctantly, he gave way to the Guardian. He shouldn't have stayed so long watching the new temple, thought the Guardian unhappily. But he'd never seen anything like the taint that spread from the temple through Radern. He'd been worried about Henea. The Forest King had made him responsible for her safety, and there was nothing safe about the temple. The geas that bound her made it impossible for him to stop her from going in, but he'd stayed and fretted over it until Jess had convinced him that Mother would know what to do about it. In wolf form, the Guardian looked for Rinny's scent along the edge of the forest, but Jess had been right. She hadn't followed Mother. He went back to the cabin. Gura flattened himself submissively, but the Guardian ignored him. Gura shouldn't have let Rinny go off alone. Dogs did not make good guards. They were taught to obey the commands of the people they guarded. Rinny's scent was here, but it was difficult to pick out one trail from another. He needed Lair for this kind of job. He lifted his head from the porch step and cast an irritated glance toward the forest. Judging by the time Henea had taken to get from the village to the place where something had happened to Papa, Mother and Lair should have been back by now. As he turned his head, he caught a whiff of an odd scent. What had Bandor been doing at the farm? He seldom visited his aunt. Both the Guardian and Jess found the village distressful. There were too many people for Jess, and he got confused by their unguarded emotions. To the Guardian, there were too many possible threats. Even so, he knew Bandor's scent of yeast, salt, and soap. The sound of rapid footsteps made him blend into the side of the porch so that he remained unseen. The wind was coming from the wrong direction, so he couldn't tell who it was until Henea came out in the open. One sleeve was burned away, and blisters started at her fingertips and trailed up fire-blackened flesh to her shoulder. She slowed to a walk, staggering slightly as she came in sight of the cabin. "Seraph," she said. "Jess, are you here?" The Guardian shook with the implied violence of her condition, even though Jess tried to soothe him with the observation that she might have done the damage to herself, because the hurt was concentrated on the wrist the geas band had been on. Henea smelled of anger, fear, and pain, and Jess was tired. The beast snarled silently. Henea gasped slightly, and the Guardian knew that she felt the dread of his anger. "Jess," she said, closing in on the cabin. "Jess, I need to talk to you. There's none here to harm anyone. Please, I need to talk to you." A tear slid down her face, and she wiped it away impatiently. "Please, I need your help." If the Forest King hadn't given her to him, the Guardian could have ignored her. But she was one of his now. So he slunk away from the porch and let her see him clearly, though Jess would rather have resumed his usual form, because he didn't want to frighten her any more than she already was. Jess liked Henea. "Jess," she said, unfazed by the monstrous wolf that stalked toward her. "Guardian, I'm so sorry. I've betrayed you all. I don't know what he's planned, but it's my fault." It was difficult to get human speech out of his wolf throat, but the Guardian managed.
"Who?"
"He planned it," she said, holding her burnt arm awkwardly away from her body.
I thought I was so clever figuring out that he was playing a game with your family. But his game was more subtle than I expected. He set me up, all but sent me out to find Seraph and tell her that I thought your father hadn't been killed. He knew that she'd go and take Lair. He knew Rinny would be left here unprotected. He didn't care about you. He doesn't know what you are. But he wants Rinny.
Jess helped the Guardian cool his rage, and the Beast welcomed the calm that would allow him to accomplish what was necessary.
He has her?
He asked.
Not when I left. I thought I might beat him here. But she's gone, isn't she? That's why you're here and not Jess.
My uncle was here,
the Guardian said.
Bandor, the village baker.
Lark, take them all, she whispered. Bandor is one of Volus's favorites. Would he turn your sister over to Volus?
He wouldn't hurt her knowingly,
said the Guardian after a moment.
But his intentions are not important.
Since Jess controlled his savagery, the Guardian was able to think clearly again and focus his purpose.
We need to find them. Can you run?
Lair was right. It was late when they reached Redurne, and Seraph was exhausted, both emotionally and physically. Only her obsessive need to force answers out of the Salcenti priest gave her the fortitude to start up the steep street of Redurne. She almost walked right past the bakery. If there hadn't been a light in Alanath's room, she might have been able to do it. Alanath loved Tyr too. Seraph hesitated outside the door.
She won't believe you, Mother, offered Lair.
Yes, said Seraph. She will, because she needs to believe it as much as I did. She gave Lair a tired smile.
She'll still think it is my fault, but at least she won't think he's dead. She has the right to know.
Seraph knocked briskly at the door.
Alanath, it's Seraph. Open up.
She waited and then knocked again.
Alanath? Bandor?
Lair tested the air.
I smell blood. Is the door locked?
Seraph tried the latch and the door swung open easily. There was no light in the front room nor the bakery, but Lair didn't need light, and she followed him to Alanath's room. The door was ajar, and Lair opened it cautiously.
Aunt Alanath?
He said, and the concern in his voice sent Seraph ducking under the arm he held the door open with. Alanath was gagged and bound hand and foot on her bed. Her face was bruised. Someone had hit her cheek and split the skin, which bled copiously all over the bedding. When she saw them, she began struggling furiously.
"Shh,"
said Seraph, sitting beside Alanath. She took out her knife and carefully slid it around swollen flesh to cut the ropes.
I'll have you free in a moment. Rinny, said Alanath as soon as the gag dropped from her mouth.
What? Asked Seraph. But Alanath had begun to shake and Seraph couldn't understand what she was saying.
Slow down,
she said, keeping her voice calm so she didn't upset Alanath further.
What about Bandor and Rinny? Did Bandor do this to you?
Alanath tried to sit up, but it was obviously painful, and Seraph hurried to help support her.
It was Bandor,
Alanath said, breathing shallowly around sore ribs.
He's gotten so strange lately. I don't know what's wrong with him. This afternoon, after the priest came, he started muttering about Rinny and you.
She stopped and swallowed.
You and I have never seen eye to eye, Seraph, but you'd die to protect your children, I know that. So when he started saying dangerous things, things that would get the whole village riled up if they heard, well, I told him he was a fool, that there was nothing evil about you and he had no call to accuse you of being shadowed.
Seraph's stomach clenched. Alanath turned her head away.
He hit me. He's done that a couple of times in the past month. I'm not saying I'm the easiest person to live with, but you know Bandor. He was never like that.
Go on,
said Seraph. This time it was more than a casual slap. I didn't know if he was going to stop. Levin, all help me, I don't think he did either. Then he muttered a bit more and said something about not needing my interference. He tied me up and left. Seraph, I don't know what he's gone to do.
He started after the priest left? Volus, not Caradoc? Asked Seraph.
Alanath nodded. I don't like that man. Did Bandor go out to the farm?
Did he say that was what he was going to do? Asked Seraph.
He said that he was going to save Rinny.
We haven't been there since early this afternoon, said Seraph. I left her with Gurra, but Gurra knows Bandor. I have to go find her. Will you be all right here?
Alanath nodded. Find him before he hurts her, she said.
Where would he take Rinny, said Lair, if he didn't come back here?
The priest, said Seraph. If he thought she was shadowed, he'd take her to the priest. We'll find them, she told Alanath.
Be careful, said Tyr's sister. Be careful, Seraph. Bandor's not the man you know.
Outside the bakery, Seraph frowned in indecision. Go to the temple, or all the way out to the farm?
Can you tell if Bandor and Rinny came by here? She asked Lair.
He shook his head.
Not even if it were full moon. There's too much.
He stiffened and looked around. Seraph felt it too. A cold chill fluttering down her spine, and a lump in her throat that made it hard to swallow.
Jess, she called. Are you here?
Listen, said Lair.
Someone's riding a horse up the road.
She saw Skew first, his white spots clearly visible in the starlight as he leapfrogged up the steep corner, hooves slipping and sliding. As soon as he was on the more level part of the road, he broke into a smooth trot and stopped in front of her.
The priest, said Hanea tightly, sliding off the horse. I was a fool. He sent me to get you to leave your daughter unprotected.
Seraph nodded.
I've come to that conclusion myself. Do you think they'd take her to the temple?
Yes.
We'll leave Skew here, said Seraph.
He'll lose his footing on the cobbles and the steep parts.
Lair, can you find some place to secure him?
There'll be space by the woodshed, he said, and took the horse.
Hanea stood a little crookedly, as if she were in pain. Seraph called a mage light and took a good look at Hanea's burnt arm.
There are easier ways to break a geas, she said dryly.
I was in a hurry, replied Hanea, her lips curving in a pale smile. And I was angry.
That's going to hurt, observed Seraph.
It already does. I'm not going to be much help in any kind of fight. My concentration is gone. I can feed your magic, though.
Good enough, Seraph said.
Lair came back, and Seraph turned and started up the road at a rapid walk. Jess and Lair could probably run all the way to the temple, but she and Hanea would have to take it slower, or they wouldn't be any good when they got there. She knew that Jess was with them by the clenching of her stomach, but she only caught a glimpse of him now and again out of the corner of her eye.
Tell me about Volus, said Seraph. Whatever you think will be useful.
He's smarter than I thought he was, obviously. The other mages in the secret path respected his power, but he's young by Salcenti standards, and complex spells frustrate him. Because of that, he tends to use the Raven Ring more than his own magic unless he's weaving an illusion.
They came to a steep bend in the road, and Hanea quit speaking until they were on flatter ground.
I told you that the wizards steal orders and wear them? Usually as rings, but there are some stones set in earrings and necklaces. He told me that some of the rings are painful to use, and some of them don't work all the time. Most of the wizards can only use one ring at a time, but Volus has two he uses. The first one bears the Order of the Raven. With it, he usually has an owl, though I've seen him with a hunter's ring a time or two as well. You'll know which one he wears when you see him. Just look.
How well does he bear the orders?
About as you'd think, she said. He seems to believe the Raven Order is just like his magic, except that he doesn't have to use rituals.
Seraph smiled in satisfaction. Tell me, does he have a bad temper? As they got closer to the temple, Lair stopped and bent down as if to touch the ground, but he pulled his hand back before it touched.
What's this, Mother?
He asked. What? Seraph stopped too, but she didn't see anything.
A taint,
said Jess. He must have been close to Hanea because she gave a nervous squeak. What does it look like?
It looks as if a foul substance was spilled over the ground, said Lair. It smells bad, too.
Shadowed, said Hanea in a small voice. I'd wondered.
It comes from the temple, said Jess. It's darker there.
It's really there? Asked Lair. Why can't you see it, Mother?
I don't know why ravens can't see the stalker's influence, or why larks can't either, replied Seraph.
I can understand why the ancients didn't feel it necessary for owls or cormorants, but larks and ravens have to deal with shadowing.
Unto each order, murmured Hanea. Are the powers so given? Yes, yes, I know. It is still stupid. So Volus is most likely shadowed. It was a very rare condition. Seraph had never dealt with someone who was shadowed, though her teacher had. He'd died before he taught her much about it because there was so much else to learn. She knew the stalker needed some destructive feeling or act to gain influence, and the amount of influence varied. The shadowed had been different, her teacher said, because the shadowed had invoked the stalker's power and welcomed the shadowing. Let's go, she said. We need to get to Rinnie. They reached the temple finally, and Lair tried the door.
It's locked, he said. Barred from the inside, I think.
Seraph said something short and guttural, a summoning she would not have remembered if she'd stopped to think about it, and the door blew apart, reduced to splinters and bits of metal that covered the floor of the inner chamber.
Careful, cautioned Hanea. Anger and magic don't mix well.
Where will he take her? Seraph knew that Hanea was right, but ever since the huntsman had come to tell her that Tyr was dead, she'd been more frightened than she'd been since the night her brother died. And fear, like grief, made her angry.
Follow me.
The temple was brightly lit with wall sconces, so Seraph had no trouble picking her way through the debris left by the door. But the room on the other side of the curtain was quite different than the one she remembered. It was a rectangular room, with a low ceiling. There were no flying birds, no arched ceiling. Is this the real room, or is the chamber with the orders the real room? She asked Hanea. Which do you think? This room was more in keeping with a building that had been put up in less than a season's time. It was not too different from Willen's store, and she couldn't smell magic in it at all. But the other one is real, she said with conviction. That room had been too detailed to have been an illusion set up just for her, but he couldn't show that room to just anyone. This chamber looked just as the villagers would expect. Hanea nodded her head. As I told you, he is a very good illusionist. There was a small door set unobtrusively near the back wall, and Hanea led them through it and down a narrow stairway.
We're close now, Hanea said. We should be as quiet as we can.
Rinny's been here, whispered Lair.
I can smell her fear,
agreed Jess, already at the bottom of the stairway. The stair ended in a short, dark hallway that smelled of earth and moisture to Seraph. But Lair's nose was wrinkled with disgust, and he was careful not to bump against the wall. Light pooled by an open doorway. Seraph brushed by the others to enter the room first. Rinnie was there. Like Alanath, she'd been tied and gagged, but Seraph didn't see any bruises. Relief washed over Seraph. Rinny wasn't safe yet, but she was alive. Several hundred candles were set out to form five circles on the floor with Rinny in the middle of the center circle. The others each contained a bit of jewelry, with a single large stone in the setting. Volus was there too, peering over a fragile-looking scroll laid out on a table almost too small for it. He didn't look up as they entered. As Hanea had advised, Seraph looked at his hands and saw two rings. One of them should be Raven. Seraph focused her magic and looked at the rings. Raven and Owl, just as Hanea had predicted, but twisted somehow and empty. Wrong. In the far corner of the room, Bandor sat cross-legged on the floor, rocking back and forth and muttering to himself. Owl sick, thought Seraph. Unbound by traveler laws, Volus had forced Bandor to do something against his will, and Bandor was paying the price. She took another step forward and ran into a barrier of magic. With a quick flick of thought, she made the barrier visible. It arched across the room, leaving Volus, Bandor, and Rinny on one side of the barrier, and the rest of them trapped on the other. Trapped because the barrier now covered the doorway and sealed them all in. At least she assumed they were all there. She hadn't seen Jess in the quick glance she'd taken. Volus, Seraph said. Her voice trembled with fury. She'd thought she had herself under better control. She was so angry at him and at those unknown men who were like him and played havoc in their ignorance. They had stolen Tyr, Rinny, and Seraph's peace. They would pay, all of them. Painfully, she drew the serenity of her training around her like a cloak. It was Volus who had to lose his temper. When she was certain she was calm, she said, "What are you doing?"
"Summoning the Stalker," he said without looking up. "I've been expecting you, as you can see. Once my little raven took flight, I thought she'd bring you here. At first I was upset with her, but then I thought it would not be a bad thing to have an audience, as long as they didn't become part of the ceremonies."
Guardians were all but immune to magic. Jess could go through the barrier. It was just possible he could get through, retrieve Rinny, and return across the barrier with her. But if he couldn't, he would never leave her. Trapped there, he would try to protect Rinny from Volus, and that was unacceptably dangerous. She'd send him there only if there was no choice. She could tell that Jess had reached the end of his control, because the temperature in the room was dropping rapidly. "You are an ignorant fool," she said coldly. "The eagle is not the Stalker. The Stalker is what made the Shadowed what he was. If you manage to summon it, you will not be more. You will be nothing. The Stalker has no followers because anything that answers to it becomes a thing just as it is."
"Don't think I don't know about people like you," said Volus. "My first teacher liked to tell me how ignorant I was because he was afraid of me and what I could do. So for years I did his bidding as his apprentice. When the master of the secret path found me and told me the truth, the first thing I did was arrange for my teacher to receive a lesson ensuring that he never had a chance to mislead anyone again."
Satisfaction colored his voice.
"Take warning from that. You say I am wrong, but you don't know me. Don't know what I can do."
The growing cold made Seraph shiver, but she trusted that Jess would hold on a few minutes more. She needed to make this boy angry.
"Oh, I know what you can do," said Seraph serenely. "Do you think that Hanea spent the whole day silent? Or do you think that I should tremble before an illusionist?"
She saw her tone made him flush. Salcenti wizards looked down upon illusionists, saw their magic as a lesser thing because it neither created nor destroyed. Salcenti wizards were fools about many things.
"A boy barely old enough to dress himself. A Salcenti conjurer who defiles himself with the dead
because he has to steal their magic, or everyone would know how ignorant he was?
I may be an illusionist, he said with careful dignity.